Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. It follows the fortunes of myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, a big welcome to you.
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good indeed. And listen, before we get going into this podcast today, and without wishing to drive it home too intensely to our audience, I'm sure you are as aware as I am that on this day in 1981, a man called Chapman was charged officially with the murder of John Winston Lennon.
Doesn't go away, does it?
No, never.
He's coming up for parole again this year.
You'll never get it.
I don't think he'll ever get it.
No, he'll never get it. I read on one occasion, because I think Yoko Ono objects every time, doesn't she?
Wouldn't you? Yeah.
Well, of course I would. But the last time I read it from an American point of view, and some commentator over there said they could never let Chapman out for his own safety. He said it'd be a queue, you know, longer than the height of the Empire State Building of people who'd want to try and get him.
Would anybody really, truly risk their own liberty to assassinate the guy who assassinated the greatest rock star of all time?
No, but they might arrange for his death, if you see what I mean. I don't think anybody's going to stand there and shoot him like he shot down John Lennon. But I think people would like revenge on him. My greatest bugbear about this is the horrendous crime and cold-blooded killing, shooting a man in the back and all that, happened to be John Lennon. Chapman had no right to steal John Lennon from this earth. John Lennon was unique. He was a talent and a quality of a person that is so rare in the history of the world. It was an utter disgusting crime to steal a man like that from earth.
It was, you know, but the problem we have is, of course, that derangement is not rational.
Yeah.
And we've seen so much of it lately, haven't we? Somebody who is not of sane mind
Absolutely.
Will commit atrocities.
Yes.
And they don't understand, I don't believe, what they've done.
Yeah.
They have to be sociopathic, if not worse,
yeah,
in some way or another, to be able to do such a thing.
That's right. Well, I hope 40 years on, he's just reflecting that his one moment of glory, which apparently was what he was after, oh, I want to be John Lennon for a day, you know, so I better get rid of the original John Lennon. Hope he's had 40 years to reflect on whether that was worth him denying himself his liberty for the rest of his life. But I dislike him so much, I don't want to talk about him. Let's move on to another very interesting subject, and that is my new sausage pan, Leslie Ann. Now, have you been following the saga of my sausage pan over the last few days?
With some bemusement, Mike. Now, talk me through the sausage pan.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you what, because of lockdown and all that, I mean, I'm using an awful lot more cooking utensils because I never used to cook for myself every day. You know, you would bring in a takeaway, you would eat out with your friends, you would sometimes go without food because you'd had a very long day and get a sandwich on the train on the way home or something like that. You know what I mean? But I found
out... Oh, you don't eat on the train, do you? Oh, that's disgusting.
Well,
I've always loathed the idea of eating on public transport. It's horrible.
Well, only if it's cold food and I'm starving. I can't stand people who bring, you know, horrible, you know, food full of odour on. Some of those disgusting people bring on that stuff from South Korea. It's called, you know, obi-subi or something like that. Wobi-obi.
Oh, it's gross. Whatever it is, it's gross.
And it's in a big plastic bucket. And the minute they take the lid off, it's like you know, putting gas into the blinking carriage. And I object terribly to that. But sometimes I'm so hungry and I know I'm going to go to bed as soon as I get home because I've been working since 4 and it's now 10 o'clock in the evening. I do sometimes get a sandwich, but I'm very discreet about it and you know, it doesn't have any odour and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, the point of my story is that I've been using cooking utensils and I realise that no matter how much you wash a pan or even scrub it or even use a Brillo pad on it, they're never gleamingly clean for long. You know what I mean? They get stained by fat and grease and all that kind of stuff. So I decided I've got an individual sausage pan. It's a little pan in which I do my sausages and nothing else, okay? And it had got all coated up. And I thought it had its day, so I threw it out. I bought a new one in Morrison's, the supermarket, for £4.80, okay?
Bargain.
Steel aluminium one. So yesterday I thought I'd treat my audience on social media to an introduction to my pan, and I put some sausages in it and I got a an amazing response. First of all, people objected to the sausages, then they objected to the pan, then they objected to the fact that there was a packet of Tesco bacon in the background as well, then wanted to know why I was eating what they considered to be rubbish food. Was I using a very sort of health conscious type light spray, whatever you call it, you know, to cook the food in, like sunflower oil or something, you know what I mean?
Or coconut spray, yeah.
Coconut which spray, is something like that, one, yeah. Whatever it was, yeah. And so the debate went on. I then defended myself against the particular sausage variety because I like Richmond sausages, Richmond Irish sausages, and the one I like in particular, the skinless sausage. So I displayed a full pack from the freezer of my, because I've got them stored in the freezer in case I run out, my skinless sausages. And again, it caused a lot of debate. At the end of the day, over 120,000 people had got in touch, and I'm very grateful to them. Thank you very much indeed. But I defend my right to eat my sausages cooked in my own sausage pan.
Well, of course you can. You can do whatever you like. But yeah. I'd probably have to argue with you that the very best kind of sausage is a barbecued one in a bun, burnt to a crisp, you know, done over the charcoal. Would you not agree?
Not for me. The really? Taste of coal. Taste of coal. I don't like barbecue food. Taste of coal to me. And by the way, I pointed out to some of these people that I think it was last year or the year before, somebody sent me a hamper from Fortnum and Mason, okay? And
very nice.
That hamper were their, you know, prize sausages, absolutely the best they've got in the shop, pork and leek. And they were ghastly, honestly. I mean, you know.
That sounds like an instruction, pork and leek.
Yeah, pork and leek. That's right. It does, doesn't it? Yeah. But, you know, I thought the skins were too tough. I didn't like the content. I didn't like the malleability. I like my sausages to be malleable, and the malleability of them wasn't good enough. And so,
what does that mean, malleability?
Well, I don't like a sausage to be like too solid, if you see what I mean. I like it to be, you know, you can poke your knife and your fork into it. You know what I mean?
Want to sort of melt in the mouth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
quality
yeah.
to yeah. it. Yeah. Absolutely. So, have you ever tried a vegetarian sausage?
No, I never would. No. I don't like anything vegetarian because I think people say that, oh, you know, meat's this, meat's that. Anything vegetarian, which pretends to be meat, is obviously a manufactured product, isn't it? So it can't be good for you if it's...
But it's made of plants, isn't it? So it can't be bad for you, exactly.
It's meant of something that's not natural meat. So if you tried to get something to imitate a plant, it would be wholly false. And if you get a plant to imitate meat, it is, in my view... incredibly false. I've got some exciting news for you, Leslie Ann. I may well be in a position to have a drink outside a pub by the end of this week. I have a plan.
Tell me.
Well, there's a pub called The Horseshoe, and it's near London Bridge, near where the offices in which I work are located. And they are now ahead of the game, and they've got a sort of kiosk point there where you can get a couple of beers, sit on tables outside. Obviously, there's all the social distancing. But I think the whole pack of cards might collapse this week because we're inevitably, I think, you know, within 24 hours of this podcast being made, going to hear of a reduction in the 2 metres or 1 metre. That is, a clarion call to get moving on opening pubs and restaurants, all that kind of stuff. And already I know, because I've been invited, I know that lock-ins are going on all over the country. In fact, I read a report over last weekend that the police had raided one in somewhere like Preston or something like that and found 8 people, you know, in the back room of a pub and did them for social distancing. Now, I've been invited to 2 or 3 in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, right? And what happens is, you know, a select bunch of regulars sit in the room, they sit 2 tables apart, they can talk to each other. And the only reason I haven't gone is because I knew the individuals concerned would be too boring for me to want to spend a couple of hours with them. But
You are choosy about the company you keep, Michael.
I am very choosy about the company I keep, Leslie, and you know that. That's why you are one of the few people that I choose to dine with occasionally. When I occasionally dine. But some people will literally risk their lives now for a pint of beer, you know.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. I was talking to Simon Napier-Bell, who was George Michael's manager back in the day. He lives in Thailand now. And of course, the rules there have been very different from what we've had to endure here.
Yeah.
But he said he read a piece in the New York Times, which he and I both then tried to find online and couldn't. And it was a basic story of a family going through the forest and they're being pursued by a bear. They think they're going to be eaten and die. And then they come across this little shack. Yeah. So they go in the shack, they lock themselves in, and the shack is stocked with everything they need to survive for, you know, the duration.
Yeah.
And then they run out of everything. Mm-hmm. And then they have to come outside. And of course, the bear is still there waiting for them.
Yeah.
And the bear in this instance is the coronavirus. And it is still there. It is still deadly. And social distancing and extreme vigilance are still vital. Mm. I don't want to put a damper on your story, but we do still have to be massively careful. And I'm worried about you for being out there.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm going to be massively careful because I am very vulnerable. In fact, I wonder whether I am actually immune. And the reason I say that is that last week there was this exciting news about a beta blocker, which had been discovered to help people who are recovering. Okay, now, I take two beta blockers a day. I take a tablet called digoxin, another one called carvedilol, and they are both designed to stimulate my heart. Beta blockers do that. You know, they support weak muscle. And I wonder, I've been taking these now for 16 years, and I honestly wonder whether some combination of the drugs I take to keep my heart in shape have helped me in some way to avoid the COVID-19 virus.
What's your blood type?
Don't know. But I also take vitamin D every day, right?
Well, I was going to say I take that as well every single day.
Yeah.
But there's new information regarding blood type.
Yes.
The three most dangerous conditions, let's call them, the factors in being susceptible to coronavirus. If you are male, if you are over 60, and if you fall within the blood type A, so that's A negative or A positive.
Right. I don't.
So you're kind of two out of three, aren't you?
Yeah,
knowingly.
I should know my blood type. I have my bloods taken often enough. In fact, funny enough, I got a phone call from the surgery just the other day saying that my latest round of blood tests had come back. They're all okay, you know, no great problems and all that. But I've never really bothered to ask anybody what it is. Now, by the way, talking about Simon Napier-Bell living in Thailand, did you ever come across, or have you ever come across a guy called Steve Lillywhite, who runs U2?
Yeah. I used to know him pretty well because he was married to a great friend of mine, Kirsty MacColl.
Exactly.
Do you remember her? Lovely singer.
Yes.
Who died in tragic circumstances.
Absolutely. Well, Steve was a big fan of the late night radio show I used to do. And he used to ring in all the time. He came over to Britain. We met him. But I didn't find out till years later that Kirsty MacColl had been his wife and that she actually rescued that song, what's it called, of New York at the Christmas?
The Fairy Tale of
Fairy
New
Tale
York.
Of New York. She
rescued Shane McGowan of the Pogues,
That's right, yeah, she rescued it. It was a mess and she came in as lead singer. Not only that, Steve told us that she actually also rescued the Joshua Tree, which before Steve got hold of it, you know, to produce it, was a collection of disparate tracks and nobody knew what the direction of the album was. And she picked out, there were loads more tracks available for the Joshua Tree, but she picked out the ones that she thought going to make it and took a lot of credit for putting it together.
Terrifically underestimated songwriter and a musician, you know, and she was such a lovely person.
Yes.
And she died in a speedboating accident
off
the coast of Mexico with her kids.
Yeah.
There was, you know, somebody behind a speedboat on a, you know, water skiing coming along, and they were in a little pedalo or a boat or something, her and the kids. And she could see this guy coming. He hadn't seen them, and the rope would have cut them all in half.
Right.
So she pushed her kids out the way and she took the hit.
Yes.
And she was killed. And as far as I remember, nobody was ever tried for that crime.
Yeah.
But there's a bench in, you know, Soho Square, just opposite where MPL is, McCartney's office.
Yes, I do, yeah.
There's a bench in tribute to her in Soho Square.
Oh, golly. That's lovely. The FA headquarters used to be in Soho Square.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Those things at sea with speedboats and dinghies are such a tragedy. There was a chap who worked at Sky. You probably remember this story. He had a country home down in Cornwall. And they kept a rubber boat, you know, in an RIB, rigid inshore boat or rigid inflatable boat, kept one in the boathouse, and they used to go out and didn't water ski. They used to go out on the water, you know, and speed around, go for picnics in little coves and that kind of stuff. And one day he just said to his wife, come on, let's go around one more time in this sort of, this lake they used. And he pulled the lever forward for the engines and grabbed the wheel at the same time to turn the boat. And the boat reared up and threw them all out. And the wife who was driving didn't have that dead key that you keep around your neck into the ignition so that if you get thrown out the boat, the key comes out and the engine stop. She wasn't wearing it. And the boat went round the lake three or four times, killed the husband, killed one of the children and chopped the leg off another one.
I remember this. It was a dreadful tragedy, wasn't it?
Utterly horrendous. And I've read an interview with that poor woman ever since and the way she's come to terms with life. You know, she said the minute she went into the water, she knew that her life was about to change very dramatically. And what was she going to do if she lost one or more of her children? She said she just knew, you know, just instinct told her we're doomed. Terrible.
So
anyway, let's talk about matters which are not quite so as depressing. Now, you have frequented the world of showbiz and Hollywood and all those sort of things for decades now, Leslie Ann. Not that I'm suggesting that
I'm not that ancient.
No, you're not ancient or long in the tooth, but you started very young, very experienced. I've come across this amazing.
Just a child.
A child, absolutely. Now, I've come across this amazing book called Miss Aluminium, written by a woman called Susanna Moore. And although it refers to Hollywood up to sort of 50 years ago and back to the 60s, it's the most salacious account I've ever read of the misbehaviour that goes on in Hollywood. Just to explain to you, this is a family show, right? So I don't want people to think that in any way we're lowering our standards. But
here he goes again.
Yes, absolutely. But this woman tells of a tale of that amazing film director. What was his name? John something.
John Huston.
Huston.
Angelica Huston's dad.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. John Huston, who was a sex maniac and used to corral young female actresses and to do things for him. But there's one terribly distressing tale. A young woman who had to go and visit Mr. Huston at regular intervals and perform a sexual act on him, as we might say. But he was so old and knackered, he was had an oxygen mask over his face attached to a metal oxygen tank. And this poor woman had bumps on the back of her head from the number of times the oxygen tank swung in and hit her on the head as she was performing this erotic duty.
Come on, family show.
Yeah,
as you would say.
I know. I mean, that's pretty disgraceful. Are you aware of this book, Leslie Ann?
Well, yes, I am. You know, I have to say, it's not the first of its kind. You might remember, Kenneth Anger's book back in the day called Hollywood Babylon, which was a very famous book a Hollywood filmmaker, published in 65.
Yes.
It was banned 10 days later, and it's not even as bad as this one that she's written.
Wow.
And it wasn't republished until 1975, and that was about Hollywood in the 1900s to the 1950s.
Yeah.
So this is the next step along.
Right.
It's interesting that she's called it Miss Aluminium, because of course in America they say aluminum, so they've spelled it differently for the British market. But apart from that, I think it's quite an important book, actually.
Yeah.
Because what she's really writing about are the masks that we women wear to meet social expectations, causing us to forget who we are. So women in Hollywood in that era were just playthings for men to use. And that's what she's really writing about. She had an affair with Jack Nicholson, didn't everyone? She was raped by a fashion designer. Yeah. She was beaten to a pulp by her first husband.
Golly.
And, you know, we all think of Hollywood as being so ritzy and so glitzy, the parties, the clothes, the celebrity pals.
Yeah.
It's all about as deep as a sweat stain.
Yeah.
And the real story here is this woman's self-reinvention. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, well, that's great. See, I mean, some of the insights are fantastic. She reveals that Warren Beatty, right, was so anxious to keep up his reputation as a Lothario who, you know, was into horizontal refreshment 24 hours a day, that whenever anybody rang him, he would always leave it a few seconds and a few rings, then answer it, and pretend to be deeply out of breath. You know what I mean? And when anybody said, hey, Warren, what are you doing? He says, don't ask. You know what I mean?
I'm on the job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He'd probably die on the job. He'd be one of those, wouldn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, those sort of insights, I think, are absolutely fascinating. But anyway, listen, from Hollywood and the silver screen, let's go to another massive international stage, which has come to my attention this week. And that is the fact that your uncle, Cliff Jones, the revered Tottenham Hotspur footballer of double cup-winning and league-winning fame, I didn't realise, Leslie Ann, he played against Pelé in one of Pelé's first ever international games when your uncle was playing for Wales. What an astonishing new chapter that I've learned about his career.
Oh, this is, you know, famous family lore, really. This was the 1958 World Cup tournament. And, of course, Wales played Brazil in the quarterfinal. Pelé's goal finished them off. He always said, he still says to this day, that the result would have been different if the great John Charles hadn't missed the game through injury.
Yeah, that's
right. What a great experience to have played against each other. And we do have a photograph, quite a recent one, actually, of Cliff and Pelé together. It's a fantastic shot.
Oh, it is absolutely fantastic. The report I saw, I mean, what's happened is these days, before football came back, which has now happily come back, even though it's without fans, a lot of the papers have been sort of, you know, going back through the archives and finding out what happened on this day all these years ago. So it says here, Wales were knocked out of the World Cup in the quarterfinals by a Brazilian 70-year-old wonder kid called Pelé. Absolute right. Team netted in the decisive strike. Wales wing wizard Cliff Jones said exactly what you've just said. To this day, if we'd had Big John, it may have been a different result. One of the first ever footballer profiles I read was John Charles's autobiography, because he was such an extraordinary guy. You know, he was the first player really of any note to go and play in Italy, play for Juventus, where he was an absolute god and still is to these days. But the most amazing thing about him, which I'm sure your Uncle Cliff will have told you, is that John Charles could appear on the team sheet as centre forward and score a record number of goals, or he could appear on the team sheet as centre half and stop a record number of goals. He was apparently the all-round genius.
Very versatile player and also a gentle giant.
Yes.
You know, he was a big guy, but my father adored him, absolutely worshipped John Charles.
Yeah, no, I should imagine he would, because, you know, a guy like... I think his book was called The Gentle Giant, actually. And years later, when he came back to England, he played for Leeds United, I remember. And I've done a couple of England games at Leeds. And again, they still revere him there. There's still pictures, you know, of Gentle John, the big giant, down the corridors at Elland Road, despite the fact that he's competing with the people like Billy Bremner, you know, and Jack Charlton, all that kind of stuff. But you're absolutely right. It's, you know, he was a legend amongst legends. Now then, Leslie Ann, I didn't know until I started talking to you about a service we're going to bring to our readers' attention, a babble, that you are in fact a linguist.
Oh, I am, yes. I read modern languages at the University of Westminster way back.
Yeah.
And French and Spanish are my second and third languages.
And can you still speak them quite fluently?
I can, you know, I get a bit rusty.
Yeah.
I try and keep my hand in reading newspapers and stuff online. But when I go back to a French or a Spanish speaking country, I find within sort of 24 hours, I slot right back in. So those skills have never really left me.
Yeah. OK, well, I envy you because I want to get into languages. I know I'm a gentleman who's, you know, had a long career, but I think I've got time now to expand my knowledge. And I speak a little bit of French, you know, s'il vous plaît, you know, aujourd'hui, maintenant, all that kind of stuff, you know.
You sound like Del Boy.
Yeah, I do sound like Del Boy. And I could get by a little bit in a French bar. But this new service, Babbel, this new product, it's a language learning system, okay? And it's the sort of thing that I could really get on well with. I'd love to be able to speak French or German or Italian or something like that, just to be able to go to another country and hold my own. And with Babbel, which incidentally is spelled B-A-B-B-E-L, and you can acquire this service by going to babbel.co.uk, or you can download the app for free. you can learn so easily, okay? And when I say so easily, what I mean is that, for instance, when you get the service, it's up there, you're online, you look at it, the clear interface to guide you through is exceptional.
Oh, and they also teach real-life conversations, so you're learning through interactive dialogue, speech recognition technology, and that helps you to improve your pronunciation and your accent.
Yeah.
The lessons are actually created by language experts,
yeah,
which is real people.
That's absolutely fantastic. And you can do it with daily lessons of as little as 10 to 15 minutes. Now, you talked about the languages that you know all about, 14 different languages available on Babbel, all the major European ones and many more around the world. The teaching methods are effective across multiple studies, which is a great thing.
Oh, yeah, and you can get them as an app or online, and they track your progress and they sync it across all your devices.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So I'm very impressed with this, OK? Just to remind people, try Babbel today. Just go to babbel.co.uk or download the app for free.
And that's Babbel, BABBEL.co.uk or download the app to try for free.
Absolutely. Babbel, learn a new language and make it your own. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, the podcast that brings you everything from the Cosmo. Myself, Mike Porky Parry, and of course, Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Leslie Ann, you won't believe what I've come across in the last few days, okay? There's some celebration going on about ABBA, and lo and behold, I open one of my journals to find a recollection from the first ever big ABBA concert when they'd had a couple of hits. And the report came from the man who was there, who watched it all the way through and said ABBA nearly didn't make it. They were so nervous. And it was written by a very old friend of yours called Garth Pearce.
Oh, gosh, I haven't heard about him for years.
Neither have I. I thought he was dead. Yeah. With the greatest respect to Garth, if he's still alive.
Well, I don't know. That is something we need to find out.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he is, because this was written very contemporaneously, you know, talking about this concert. But I'd read something about that before, that Agnetha or the other girl, Anifred, they simply got terrible stage fright, and that's why they did so few live concerts. That's a bit odd, isn't it, for somebody who's the biggest rock star in the world?
Well, I mean, I don't think she set out to be a biggest rock star in the world.
Yeah.
Agnetha, the beautiful blonde,
yes.
She was a singer from a very young age back in Sweden, but it never really occurred to her to chase the pop and rock market.
Yeah.
I think she was into sort of folk and classical music to begin with.
Yeah.
She'd been a singer since she was a child. But they got caught up in that whirlwind and then they won Eurovision, didn't they?
That's right.
I think they thought of it as an experiment. And that was just, you know, just to pass the time of day, really.
Yeah.
I don't think they anticipated the enormity of the experience they were heading for.
Yeah.
And it kind of threw everything into disarray, because the more successful they became as a band, the more it took its toll on their personal relationships.
Right.
Their marriages broke up. It was
right.
A bit of a Fleetwood Mac sort of, you know, similar situation there, wasn't it?
No, it was. You're absolutely right. So I've got this in front of me by Garth Pearce, and he talks about the night, Oslo, Norway, January the 28th, 1977. So Garth,
God, we weren't even born.
I was about to say, Garth is clearly a bit older than us, isn't he?
A little bit, yeah.
Because neither of us would have been qualified in us in Fleet Street to have made that in 77. But from then on, right the way through the 80s and the early 90s, I mean, quite seriously, although I, you know, always refer to you as, you know, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, it was an incredible job to have in those sort of 15 years, wasn't it, during that period?
Oh, yeah, because rock and pop suddenly hit Fleet Street out of nowhere. Before that, the coverage, you know, celebrity entertainment, showbiz coverage was all about movie stars. So it was Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor,
yes,
and those kind of great luminary figures. And then suddenly the emphasis switched, and that was largely due to the Beatles.
Yeah.
And so every newspaper had to have its rock and pop correspondent.
Yeah.
And it also switched from the weekly sort of music papers like Sounds, Melody Maker, the NME. Suddenly the Nationals were covering this kind of thing. So they all had their correspondent, of which I became one.
Yeah.
And you're right, for about 15 years, the front pages of newspapers were flooded with rock and pop stars.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Just dominated by them. I got onto that, like hanging on the tailcoats of it, because I was based in America. So it was easier to get me to go to California or down to the Caribbean or up to Canada or something like that, where I, you know, chase around after Boy George or something, rather than them flying people over from London. Now, Leslie Ann, let me ask you this story. What do you think of a man who goes onto a dating site and uses a cat as a prop to try and convince a woman he's a lovely person?
A cat? A cat. What's he doing with the cat?
Well, I'm reading this report from one of my journals, right? If only Ernst Blofeld had stopped stroking that cat, he might have been able to set aside plans for world domination and find a nice girlfriend instead. A study has found that for men looking for love, it could be best to wait until the second date, at the very earliest, to introduce their feline friend. Apparently, a cat and a man turns women off absolutely. Why would any
guy... loaded, because it's loaded with implication, isn't it? A man stroking a pussy. Sorry. Yeah. Is, no, I mean,
but it's not
what
that,
are they doing it?
It's not even the insinuation of what you've just mentioned, which I won't repeat because, of course, this is a family show.
It's a family show.
Yeah, but it's the idea of him being gentle and feline. And it says, it seems the species of the animal matters. And while the sort of man who chooses to hug a cat on Tinder may well be seen as more gentle and caring, that may be the image he's trying to give, but he's not the kind of man who will sweep you off your feet. It's a right turn off for women.
He needs an alligator. Well, let's get him an alligator.
Yeah, or something like that. I totally agree. But, I mean, I hate cats anyway. I couldn't even...
Yeah, I do.
I couldn't pick a cat up. I think they're sly. I think they're very anti-human. They'd kill you if they possibly could. Give me a dog any day. Except that, you know, living in a penthouse, you can't have a dog, obviously. But one of these days I will have, instead of a penthouse by the sea, I'll have a cottage by the sea, and I will have a Labrador dog, and we will run up and down the beach. Well, the dog will do the running up and down the beach every morning. And I will...
eating the sausages while you amble along with a beer.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Something
nice
like that.
Image, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you ever come across, during your time in America, a female photographer called Annie Leibovitz?
Oh yeah, many times. Yeah, she took the very last pictures of. She took those last images, the famous last images of John and Yoko lying on a bed in the Dakota Building. Oh. Yoko fully dressed, and John wrapped around her body, completely stark naked.
Yes. Oh, she took those, did she?
Yeah, she did the last shoot with John during his lifetime. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. She's a fascinating woman because she first came to my attention in the sort of mid-80s, when she took that picture of which actress holding her baby bump on the front of Vanity Fair?
Oh, it was Demi Moore. Demi Moore, yeah.
Demi Moore, that's right.
I always think of Demi Lovato, and there's too many Demis around nowadays.
No, it was Demi Moore, definitely. But then, you know, any massive picture then always seemed to be taken by Annie Leibovitz. And a few years later, sort of the mid-90s, I was over in America doing something and somebody pointed out this piece to me about Annie Leibovitz. She was something like $300 million in debt.
Oh, yeah. You know, sometimes these people's lifestyle goes to their heads.
Yes.
And she maintained a massively expensive loft studio in Manhattan, which, you know, would have run into millions upon millions of dollars a year.
That's right.
A friend of mine called Nick Elgar, he used to be an assistant in the art department at Capital Radio when I was there.
Yeah.
Nick became her personal assistant and trained as a photographer under her and then became one of the better known paparazzo photographers in New York.
Really?
And the stories of excess were legendary. You know, I don't think she held back. There was that other woman, wasn't there? Martha Stewart, the sort of lifestyle expert.
Yes, yes.
Who, she went to prison, actually, for having doctored her tax accounts.
Yes.
But similarly, somebody who fame and fortune went to their head and they overstretched themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a common theme in the States.
Yeah. Apparently what she did was she had, like, you know, like a lot of artists, she had a plan for, to create a huge sort of industry, a huge sort of academy of photography and art, and everybody was going to benefit, you know what I mean, all this. So she sold the future royalties of her picture portfolio, which was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But then it all disappeared, you know, as these things often do. Mike Tyson ended up with about a $300 million debt. Well, I know Mike Tyson earned a lot. He probably earned that much. But how do you spend it? You know, you wonder, don't you?
Well, it's frightening, but also the idea that you can sell your future self.
Yeah.
That's a very American thing, isn't it? I can't imagine us getting away with that here.
I think the guy from The Who sold his future. Didn't Bowie sell his future catalogue?
Oh, actually, yeah, Bowie Bonds.
Yeah.
That's right.
He
did sell Bowie Bonds to his fans.
Yeah. But the reason I meant...
That went away very quietly.
Yeah, well, it all became sort of big business, so much money involved. But the reason I mentioned that was because I came across a piece a couple of days ago saying that three times now, photographer Annie Leibovitz has turned down the opportunity to photograph the president, Donald Trump, apparently the first one she's turned down. And she said, when Trump was elected, well, there were plans to do a shoot. But in the end, I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Photographer Annie Leibovitz only likes to work with people she admires. So, I mean, you've got to a position in life, haven't you, where you can actually turn down the president of the United States.
But if you owe $300 million, one photo shoot isn't going to make a lot of difference. And also, how do you make somebody like him look good?
Yeah. No. Well, I suppose that's right. He's got a very strange sort of pose in his face, Donald Trump. All the time it looks like whimsical or quizzical or something like that. You know what I mean? Or threatening or challenging or something. I've never seen the soft side of Donald Trump in a picture.
No, and I always have to wonder, what are all those wives that he's had, five or something, what have they seen in him beyond the money? Because he's revolting.
That's a bit harsh, isn't it? I mean...
Well, I don't think it is. Yeah. I mean, he's a very unappealing person in every way, not just physically, but, you know, in every way. Mm. But you're right, there's that pouty sort of petulant child face that he does, which I just want to slap him.
Yeah, it is. It's a permanent pouch. You're right. You know, he's sort of his top lip curls like he's Elvis or something like that. But
Maybe he is.
Yeah. I remember he tried to court Diana, Princess of Wales. Started sending her huge bunches of flowers to Kensington Palace and all that, and she was horrified. And that brings me to something else you might have an opinion on, and that is that, of course, between our last podcast and this one has been Father's Day, okay? Now, we've all talked endlessly, you and I have talked endlessly about Harry and Meghan, and they're now out of mind, out of sight, and all that kind of stuff. But I thought it was a lovely picture of Prince William and his father, Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, published for Father's Day, showing, to me, a very affectionate father and son, dad and lad type relationship.
You really think? I looked at that picture and I went to the kids. Penny for the guy.
Yeah.
He looked like he was carting Prince Charles around in a little trolley collecting money to buy fireworks.
Well, it is an odd picture in the sense that, you know, Charles looks like a country bumpkin and William is much taller than him and has pulled him in. It looks like a reverse picture of father and son. But I still think it's very, you know, I think it's, what is it, warm. I think it's warm and it shows the two of them together. And it's a complete and utter contrast to, you know, the way that we perceive Harry these days.
Yeah, maybe. But I was a bit worried by the story. You know, Lady Colin Campbell has a book on Meghan coming out quite soon.
Excuse me, she calls herself Lady Colin Campbell.
Oh, does she know?
Yeah.
Okay. I went to Jamaica with her, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Is suggesting that Meghan is planning to run for president.
Yeah, but she's mad, isn't she?
What, Lady Colin or Meghan?
Both. I mean, Lady Colin for, you know, daring to put that into print because it's so ludicrous, and Meghan for possibly spreading the idea ludicrously, you know, that she's up to it. I mean, it's just madness.
Is this not all part of the plan? You know, why is she married into the royal family, then abandoned the royal family, stole Harry, took him to America.
Yeah.
Now she's training up the empire. I mean, this could all be part of her master plan.
Well, yes, it could be. I totally agree. In fact, it's a very good point you raise, because I'm trying to, as days go by and you see less and less of Harry and Meghan, when I thought the whole idea was that she wanted the world to be her oyster and the Hollywood's going to be a platform for a great national or international distribution of her knowledge and her charity and all that. I see less and less of them every day. And I think that's because COVID-19, of course, closed everything down. People can't get about. I think it's kind of backfired on them a bit, but enough, because we always get attacked for talking about Harry and Meghan and then saying they're of no interest to anybody. Now, what might be of interest to a lot of young people, I saw this amazing piece. I was obviously far too much of a gentleman of a certain age to ever get really interested in one direction. But they were very successful, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
You know, hugely successful. Harry Styles, lead singer, yeah, and a couple of other guys. But I read this amazing piece.
Nobody knows their names.
It's all about
Harry Styles, isn't it?
Well, there's Harry and another one. The other one has appeared on a few breakfast shows.
Louis Tomlinson, I guess.
What's his name?
Louis Tomlinson,
I think you're right, and all that. But I saw this amazing piece, right, where I think there were five guys in the band, and they all had sort of girlfriends for, you know, different amounts of time. Some of them would just be fleeting, 2 or 3 month flings. Some of them lasted a couple of years. But I've got the names of them here. It's Louis Tomlinson, Liam Payne, Niall Horan, and Harry Styles, yeah? Oh, and this other guy is the guy who's been on the breakfast show, Zayn Malik. Right,
big fun.
But there's a collection now of these young girls, and I think, do they call themselves influencers? Is that right?
Yes, they do. Yeah, they have Instagram accounts, and they put up very glamorous photographs of themselves doing fabulous things all around the world.
And every one of them is a multimillionaire.
Yeah,
every one of them has got, you know, plus millions of followers, teaching them how to put makeup on or lifestyles, all that kind of stuff. But they have become multimillionaires in their mid-20s purely because they were, for a time, either a short time or a reasonable length of time, the girlfriend of a member of a pop group which lasted about 3 years. I mean, I don't know how to react to that. I certainly don't feel envious of them, because everybody's got to take their chances in life. But isn't that a bit of a sort of injustice to people with real talent?
Well, doesn't it just show us as well what youngsters value today? It's instant fame, glamour and money. In the old days, old pop star girlfriends were as dead as tea towels back in the day, weren't they? That was it. Yeah. The relationship founded and they were off the side and you never heard from them again.
Yes.
So I suppose it speaks to us of the values of the younger generation. And I find that rather sad.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I find it sad or whether it's a new opportunity for them. But I mean, for instance, supposing your youngest daughter suddenly came home to you and said, I want to be an influencer. She's an intelligent girl. You've made sure she had a great education. Would you then be angry that she was using it for something which is associated with brainlessness, even though it was going to make her very wealthy?
I suppose I would be frustrated by that. I'm fortunate that she's got a bigger brain than that. She's planning to move to China to teach English for a year. If she becomes an influencer from that environment and has something else to deliver, you know, they are pretty good at seeing the bigger picture, my kids, if I say so myself.
Yes.
I think they wouldn't do anything so shallow just to make a fast buck.
Yeah. I don't know if it's shallow. If they're all making this money, perhaps if they're very good at it, it actually is a talent, although...
Yeah, but good at what? Slapping on makeup?
Well, that's what I mean.
Is that a deep, meaningful thing to leave to the world?
I don't know. You're absolutely
right. Not really, is it?
Listen, I want to tell you this great story, okay? I want to tell you a story.
Go on.
That was Max... what's his name?
Bygraves.
Max Bygraves, that's right, yeah. I came across this, actually, in one of my journals. There's a chap called Stuart Adams. He's a chemist who worked for Boots for a lot of his life and all that. He goes to this conference in Moscow. It's a sort of chemist conference. He drinks too much vodka. Whenever I've been to Russia, the amount of vodka you drink, you lose control of, because Russians drink vodka like we in the West drink wine, and they serve it in wine-sized glasses, and it's obviously, you know, the national drink, but it's flavoured as raspberry, strawberry, banana, you name it. You can get any flavour vodka. So you end up with hangovers. Anyway, this chap wakes up one morning in Moscow where he's had a conference, had too much vodka, and he goes to his bag, which is full of all sorts of, you know, potions and chemicals, because he is a chemist and he's at a chemist convention. And he puts a few together, and by accident, he invents ibuprofen, which has since, all this happened, by the way, in 1971. And ibuprofen, for the last three decades, has been the biggest selling painkiller in the world. I mean, that is a bit like discovering the penicillin story, isn't it? And how, what was the name of the guy who invented penicillin? I've forgotten.
Sir Alexander Fleming.
Alexander Fleming, who left a growth or something overnight, didn't he? When he came back in the morning, it was all green fungus on it, and he'd invented penicillin. It's a bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the magic and mystery of science, isn't it? And almost all the great inventions have occurred by accident.
Yeah.
So you're right about Alexander Fleming. He'd thrown a petri dish away, and then he saw that this experiment, this discarded petri dish had mold growing on it. The mold was dissolving the bacteria around it.
Right.
And when he grew the mold separately, it turned out that this was penicillin, a cure for so many ills in the world.
Yeah.
But then I found another one that might be of interest to you in your condition.
Oh, yes.
The pacemaker, the way the pacemaker was developed,
right,
was by an electrical engineer called John Hopps, who was conducting research on hyperthermics and trying to use radio frequency heating to restore body temperature.
Uh-huh.
So during that experiment, he discovered that if a heart stopped beating because of cooling down, it could be started back up again by artificial stimulation.
Golly.
And this led to the pacemaker.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the great inventions, I think, have all occurred by accident. And most of them have occurred in this country as well, which is to be celebrated.
Yeah, good God, that's great. Well, this chap, Mr. Adams, now, elderly man now, obviously, doctor and vice chancellor and head of the College of Medical and Dental Sciences at the University of Birmingham, was talking to the Smithsonian Magazine, that's in America, obviously, Smithsonian Museum in Washington. And what had happened was he was trying to find a cure for rheumatism. And this ibuprofen contained some of the chemicals that they'd made for that. It was never a cure for arthritis or rheumatism, but it became the world's most effective painkiller. I love stories like that.
Amazing.
Unfortunately.
Do you remember Alan Freeman, by the way?
Alan Freeman, was, the DJ.
BBC Radio 1 DJ, yeah.
That's right, pop pickers.
That's right. And do you remember his other catchphrase was, not off?
Oh, yes, yes, I do.
So the day he died, Eric Bailey, who was one of the editors on the Mail on Sunday, phoned me.
Yeah.
And he said, did you hear Alan Freeman died? I said, yeah, really a shame. He said, did you know what he died of? I said, no. He goes, not arthritis.
Oh dear, we're a cruel lot, aren't we, really?
Aren't we just?
We are, yeah. Listen, just to finish off this week's podcast, there's been a fantastic TV series on, and I know you're not a huge TV fan, but it's called Murder in the Car Park, okay? And,
oh yeah.
And it's the Metropolitan Police's most investigated but longest undiscovered crime. 33 years ago, a bloke was found with an axe buried in his head in the car park of a pub in South London. Sydenham, I think it was, right, and it uncovered a tale of police corruption, police selling secrets to newspapers. The documentary includes old colleagues from Fleet Street, like Greg Miskew. Remember Greg?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Anton Maranchak. Do you remember Anton?
No, I don't remember him.
He was a very deep sort of journo. He loved mixing it with crime lords and all that kind of stuff. But the most amazing thing was, and I was watching all this, and then I saw one of the guys who was interviewed for it, who was at one time a major suspect and who actually served time for offences involving his relationships with police and journalists, to realise he lives in a house in an exclusive part of Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, right opposite my sister.
Oh.
Yes. You know, something like that comes on.
That's her claim to fame, then.
Say again?
That's her claim to fame.
Well, it's not really a claim to fame, because the guy's been very controversial and linked to this unsolved axe in the head murder for 33 years. We have to stress, of course, he's totally innocent of any involvement in the crime, but he's been probed by police and investigated all these years. So, you know, you never know.
You never know who you're living next door to.
You never know who you live next door to. You can't choose your neighbours. Anyway, Leslie Ann, once again, great to have had your company. Thank you for the last three quarters of an hour or so. And
thank you, Michael.
To everybody else, thank you very much indeed for listening. They can find you where, Leslie Ann?
Oh, on Twitter at LAJ Writer.
Lovely. I'm at Mike Parry 8, or you can get to us both on our Gmail account, which is planetporkypod@gmail.com. planetporkypod@gmail.com, isn't it? Not .co.uk. Yeah, that's right. planetporkypod@gmail.com. So everybody,
we'll get it right one day.
We'll get it right one day. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And look, you know, whatever happens, there is light at the end of the tunnel now. Let's hope within a few podcasts we'll be talking to you about your adventures out there in the big wide open. Until then, folks, stay safe.
Ta-ra.
So yesterday I thought I'd treat my audience on social media to an introduction to my pan, and I put some sausages in it, and I got an amazing response. First of all, people objected to the sausages, then they objected to the pan, then they objected to the fact that there was a packet of Tesco bacon in the background as well, then wanted to know why I was eating what they considered to be rubbish food. Was I using a very sort of health-conscious type light spray, whatever you call it, you know, to cook the food in, like sunflower oil or something, you know what I mean?
Or coconut spray, yeah.
Coconut
which
spray,
is
something like that,
one, yeah.
Whatever it was, yeah. And so the debate went on. He's got a very strange sort of pose in his face, Donald Trump. All the time it looks like whimsical or quizzical or something like that, you know what I mean? Or threatening or challenging or something. I've never seen the soft side of Donald Trump in a picture.
No, and I always have to wonder, what do the wives, what are all those wives that he's had, five or something, what have they seen in him beyond the money? Because he, to me, he's revolting.
That's a bit harsh, isn't it? I mean,
well, I don't think it is. Yeah. I mean, he's a very unappealing person.
Yeah.
In every way, not just physically, but, you know, in every way.
Some of those disgusting people bring on that stuff from South Korea. It's called, you know, obi-subi or something like that. Wobi-obi.
Oh, it's gross. Whatever it is, it's gross.
And it's in a big plastic bucket. And the minute they take the lid off, it's like, you know, putting gas into the blinking carriage. And I object terribly to that.